This is Talk of the Nation. I'm John Itzty in Washington, filling in for Neil Conan. There will be a huge gathering and celebration at the Vatican tomorrow as Pope John Paul II celebrates the 25th anniversary of his papacy. Cardinals, bishops, and international delegations will celebrate Mass with him in St. Peter's Square. And while Catholics at the Vatican and around the world mark the legacy of this long and influential papacy, many people are considering the future of the Church. In the U.S. especially, there are issues that Catholics are struggling with, the role of the laity and of women, and the importance of celibacy among priests. Today on Talk of the Nation, the Catholic Church in America. What are the issues American Catholics are wrangling with in their local parishes? Should the Catholic Church look to Protestant churches to make some changes? Or should the Church be looking back into its past to enhance its appeal to the Catholic laity? If you're a practicing or lapsed Catholic, what do you see as the big issue facing the Catholic Church? Are you looking for change, or are you comfortable with the status quo? Give us a call, 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. Joining me now are two people who think about these issues on a daily basis. Peter Steinfels is author of A People Adrift, The Crisis of the Roman Catholic Church in America. He also writes a biweekly column on religion and ethics for the New York Times. He joins us from our bureau in New York. Welcome.
Glad to be with you.
And on the phone from the campus of Notre Dame University is Richard McBrien, a professor of theology and the author of many books, including Catholicism and the Lives of Popes. Thank you both for joining us here on Talk of the Nation today.
I'm happy to be with you, John.
First, a question for both of you. 25 years after Pope John Paul II took office, what kind of influence does the Vatican have on American Catholics in their daily lives? Peter Steinfels, let's start with you.
Well, I think as a person, the Pope has an impact on American Catholics in terms of the model and image of living a Christian life that he gives, and some of his message, which is in many ways a politically incorrect message by American standards, say opposing both abortion and capital punishment. As you asked about the Vatican, and the Vatican during this papacy has had, I think, a different kind of an impact, one that has more to do with the institutional well-being of the American Church. And here I think the record is somewhat mixed, where a number of Vatican measures have probably undercut the ability of the American bishops to deal with fundamental problems. And a number of statements and policies have put off to the future issues like those having to do with sexuality and the role of women that the Church will have to confront.
Mm-hmm. Richard McBrien, does the American Catholic Church have a different kind of relationship with the Vatican, do you think, than the rest of the Catholic Church around the world?
I suppose I don't think it's much different, say, from the Church in Canada or throughout parts of Western Europe. It really depends on what you're comparing it with. I mean, Peter's comments just a moment ago, I agree with them all, especially on what he said about the relationship with the Vatican and the Vatican's supposed impact on the Church here. The only thing I would add about the Pope is I think for many people, the Pope is more of an icon. He's more of a symbol, personification of Catholicism, and so they can identify him with him readily. But I'm not so sure that he actually makes a difference on the thinking of Catholics and on their behavior. I think he confirms certain Catholics in the beliefs and values they already hold, and I think he challenges and or irritates other Catholics who disagree with him on especially on the issues pertaining to human sexuality.
Mm-hmm. Peter Steinfels, do you feel that the American Catholics tend to be more sort of irritated with the Vatican and the Pope, or sort of less in awe of that office than other Catholics around the world?
John, I have to say that I am somewhat uncomfortable with the fairly standard contrast between the Vatican and American Catholics, or between America and the Catholic Church. It seems to me, and that was used in the lead-in before the news that I heard, it seems to me that that's rather a cliche and a tricky one in American cultural history. The hierarchy in the United States is American and share many of the same values about freedom that Americans do. And I think that a case can be made, as Father McBrien's colleague in the history department at Notre Dame, John McGreevy, has done, that that the Catholics have a different view of freedom, a more communal, a communitarian view, and a less individualist one than is in the American cultural heritage. But the idea that the church is an authoritarian institution simply standing over and against America's cherishing of freedom, and that therefore American Catholics are particularly more irritated than Catholics elsewhere, is one that I'm rather uncomfortable with. And let me just say one more thing about your question. I think that American Catholics often have tensions or conflicts or irritations with the Church that may stem from decisions that are made in the Vatican and Rome, but I don't think most Catholics in the pews follow these matters in such detail that they necessarily even recognize the connections between a decision made in Rome and what actually happens in their parish.
Anything to add to that, Professor McBrien?
Well, yeah, I don't want to be just echoing Peter's comments. I certainly agree with what he's saying, but it would be a question of just giving a slightly different nuance to it. I think, first of all, the question of alienation or irritation, I think Western European Catholics are far more alienated from the Vatican, even from the Pope, than we are here in the United States. I mean, there was a piece in the New York Times just the other day by Frank Bruni on the state of Catholicism in Europe, and I think it's a pretty accurate account that if you talk about secularization and a distancing from traditional institutional Catholicism, it certainly happened in Europe, in Western Europe, much sooner than it happened here. We're still pretty much of a religious nation. On the question of freedom that Peter raised, again, another a nuancing of it would be that certainly official Catholic teaching, moral theology, and the social teachings of the Church do emphasize the communal nature of freedom. But I think, and Pace, my colleague here, John McGreevy, in the history department, he's a good man, but I do think that we have to be careful not to make generalizations from the other side. I think if you really were able to sample the opinion of actual Catholics in their lives here in the United States, they have a pretty individualistic idea of human freedom, pretty much like the general culture. Those of us who are professionally involved in teaching and writing and reading and studying and propagating and lecturing on the social teachings of the Catholic Church and its moral theological tradition would, of course, emphasize that communal dimension and over against a highly individualistic understanding of freedom. But I think you've got to make a distinction between what is in the heart of the Catholic tradition officially and in its intellectual community, if you will, and what in fact happens on the ground among the average Catholic, who I think mirrors very much the broader culture more than the social teachings of the Church.
All right, let's get our listeners involved. If you want to make a comment, give us a call at 800-989-8255 or email us at TOTN at NPR.org. And let's go to a caller, Bert, in San Antonio, Texas. You're on the air, Bert.
Yes. My point to make here, and I look forward to hearing their comments in the area, is that I'm a lapsed Catholic, and part of the reason for my being lapsed is that I think the Catholic Church and the Pope as well has the potential to eliminate the greatest amount of suffering by simply allowing birth control. Because through overpopulation, we have the greatest amount of poverty worldwide today. And if the church was really interested in alleviating suffering, it would embrace this and accept it for all of mankind.
Thank you, Bert. Let's ask.
Take your comments off.
Yeah, let's ask our guest, Peter Steinfels. What do you think? What would you say to Bert?
Well, I think I would say, first of all, that personally, I view the decision made in 1968 by Pope Paul VI to reassert the Church's condemnation of contraception as a decision made in the face of a papally appointed commission that suggested that that position ought to be revised. I consider that decision to have been a tragic error for the Church. And I do think that that a revision of that position would, in fact, alleviate significant suffering. I think I'd have to disagree with the caller when he suggests that it would be a kind of silver bullet that would solve all sorts of problems, population problems, and so on. I think there's good evidence that social and economic change, for example, the literacy of women in some parts of the third world has been a more effective instrument of both population control and moving away from poverty. So I both agree and disagree with some of the things that he said.
Mm-hmm. Richard McBrien, what do you think? Is the Catholic Church on the wrong side of birth control?
Well, yes, but I'm more interested in challenging, but in a very friendly way, to be sure, the caller's assumption that the Vatican or the Pope or the official church is in any way preventing Catholic married couples from limiting births by whatever means. Because Catholics are free to practice birth control. I mean, there's no laws against it, and those laws couldn't be enforced anyway. We used to have the so-called Comstock laws in my home state of Connecticut, but those have gone by the board. So, whatever the church's official teaching on birth control, artificial contraception, it doesn't really make any difference in terms of the behavior of Catholics in this country and in most developed countries. Where it has its impact is in areas where the church, and this is a diminishing number of countries, by the way, but wherever the church has been influenced, directly influenced by official Catholic teaching, and therefore incorporated into its legal structure laws that would prevent, for example, the availability, the sale of contraceptive devices. And the irony there is that, say, in a very Catholic country like Poland, for years, because effective contraceptives were not available, they were opposed by the church of that country, in line with the Vatican, we had a higher incidence of abortion because the pressure on young couples to limit births, they were living in small apartments, living often with their in-laws and so forth, made it, left them almost no alternative. And, of course, that's, Poland is opening up and a lot of other countries. So I would say in summary that as much as one might disagree with and even deplore the church's continuing emphasis, especially, on contraception and affirming or asserting that it's immoral and so forth and so on, in many parts of the world, it really doesn't make any difference. And I agree with Peter, there are other ways in which the regulation of births is taking place with the increase of literacy, education, and so forth.
Mm-hmm. We're talking about the future of the American Catholic Church. What should the 21st century American Catholic Church look like? If you were part of the church hierarchy, how would you advise your superiors to attract more people to the Catholic Church? Call us at 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK, or send us an email. The address is totn@npr.org. I'm John Idsty. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm John Idsty in Washington, filling in today for Neil Conan. Pope John Paul II is celebrating his 25th anniversary, and we're talking about the future of American Catholicism. If you are a Catholic in America, what do you think are the biggest issues facing the church today and in the future. Our guests are Peter Steinfels, the author of A People Adrift, The Crisis of the Roman Catholic Church in America. He's also a columnist on religion and ethics for the New York Times. Also, Richard McBrien is with us. He's a professor of theology and the author of many books, including Catholicism and the Lives of Popes. Join the discussion. Give us a call at 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. What would you change or keep the same about the Catholic Church you attend? Or if you're a lapsed Catholic, what would have to be different about the Church for you to want to be a part of the congregation again? Actually, that sets us up to talk a little bit about some statistics, Peter Steinfels. I wonder if we could ask you to help us out there. How many Catholics are there in America? What percentage of all Americans are Catholics? How many go to church? Is attendance rising or falling?
Well, a caveat about all statistics, they're less precise than often the impression is given. For example, do you count Catholics by registering the results of a national sample where people are asked what their religion is, or do you count Catholics on the basis of the registration figures sent in by parishes across the nation? That warning given, there are at least 67 million Americans who identify in some way or another as Catholics. They constitute anywhere from 23 or 24 to perhaps 25 or 26% of the American population. That percentage is not changing in any major way. About a third of those Catholics are non-white, with the and certainly the number of Hispanic Catholics is growing quite rapidly. Catholics used to attend church, although we don't have very good findings on that, but in the 1950s, probably about 75% of them went every Sunday. That figure is probably down to somewhere between 25 and 33% right now. There's about 19,500 parishes covering almost every inch of the nation. They are under the supervision of bishops in 195 different dioceses, which often act quite autonomously rather than in a national united fashion.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask you about immigrants. Certainly, you said the number of Hispanic members of the church is growing. Is the number of immigrants, is the overall church growing, and to what extent are immigrants playing a part in that, or are they keeping the church from shrinking?
I think the general conclusion is that immigration from traditionally Catholic areas, particularly Latin America, is a crucial factor in the growth of the church in the United States. And those immigrants are also complemented by immigrants from the Philippines, from Vietnam, and so on. Interestingly enough, though, many of the immigrants get really active in the church. They get evangelized here, not in the country which they come from, where they often were Catholic, but because there was a kind of overall cultural Catholicism, they didn't make personal choices or get so involved as they often have after they've come to the United States.
Let's get our listeners involved again. We'll go to Anthony in Miami, Florida. Hello, Anthony.
Hi, how are you doing? Thanks for taking my call.
Do you have a question or a comment?
Just sort of a comment. I was hoping to raise the point that Catholics disagreeing with the Pope or the hierarchy on certain issues, American Catholics doing this, doesn't necessarily constitute a crisis in the church. You know, in light of especially the ecclesiology that came out of Vatican II, I would think that a thinking lady that really maybe tries to look at Catholic social teaching, look at their daily lives, and make sense of that in their own way could be a sign of a healthy church or a church that's actually thinking and not just following what they're told to do.
Mm-hmm. Richard McBrien, well, how would you comment on that?
Well, I certainly couldn't disagree with the remark. I mean, one of the
one of the most positive developments that's occurred in the Catholic Church, especially in the United States, from about the middle of the 20th century on, is that because of the vibrancy and successes of our quite extensive network of Catholic universities and colleges, as well as our high schools and parochial schools, but especially our higher educational institutions, we have now the best educated Catholic laity in the history of the Church. And with education comes critical thinking. That's what differentiates an educated person from one who hasn't had the advantages of education. The latter tend to be more prone to accepting the assurances of authority figures that such and such is so. Educated people are not cynical. They're not naturally skeptical so much as they are critical, and that they are taught to examine what they are given, to study it, to review it, to evaluate it, and to be open to alternate points of view. And so I think we Catholics, and especially those who are in positions of official leadership, should say, hey, listen, this is the price of progress. We have a wonderful system of Catholic higher education in this country. We're proud of it. But with it comes a laity that are not only better informed, but more assertive and more critical. And we've got to expect that, and we should learn from it. We should learn from the feedback we get from our highly educated laity.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to another.
I'd add to that the problem that we have, that we tend to equate all disagreements as though a disagreement, say, about the morality of the use of contraceptives or the place of celibacy in the church is equivalent to the question of whether Catholics agree about whether Jesus is the Son of God and whether the story of the Jesus's crucifixion and resurrection is a basic paradigm for understanding all of reality. There are some things that are much more central, and there's a tendency, which, I'm in the media too, the media often has, of focusing on less central elements as though they were central.
May I add just a line to that, John?
Sure, Richard McPrine.
Again, I agree with Peter, but let me add a line. Part of the reason for that failure to see the difference between what is essential and what is not essential, and most things are not essential, I think lies on the shoulders of the hierarchy themselves, because they tend to focus too much on non-essential things and leave the impression that these non-essential things, I'm not saying non-important, but non-essential things are in effect essential. And so many of the issues that, get a play in the media are issues which the Vatican or bishops or even the Holy Father himself, constantly are raising. And they're not issues of central, of the basic elements of our faith. Contraception, for example, is a doctrinal issue, but it's nowhere near being a dogma. And clerical celibacy, which Peter mentioned, isn't even a doctrine. It's simply a discipline, and it's not practiced universally in the Catholic Church. There are literally thousands of married Catholic priests in the non-Roman, that non-Latin Rite Catholic churches.
Mm-hmm. Well, we want to talk a lot more about that later on. Let's go on to a caller, though. Greg in San Diego, you're on the air.
Yes, good morning from San Diego. This is a real joy for this cradle Catholic to speak a little bit about my experiences in the church and through elementary school and high school and right in the middle of Vatican II. I think that there is a generation gap between, say, the World War II generation, my parents' generation, and the baby boomers. I can recall that during the Second Vatican II, when changes came about, there were things, how can you have a mass that's not in Latin, or the Catholic Church is becoming like the Protestants. And, I lived in Rochester, New York at the time, and it's a fairly liberal area for, in the Northeast, but still there was this backlash against, these windows, the aggiornamento that Pope John 23rd began, and, I think that it's been the younger generation, the baby boom generation, that has really felt comfortable with this democratization of the American church. I don't consider myself ever having been a lapsed Catholic. I've kind of been on the edges at times, but I don't think I've ever felt lapsed or alienated, except up in, you know, the present moment. You know, I am really, really concerned about the fallout from certainly from the actions, but the cover-up, that perceived cover-up, you know, whether it be Cardinal Law in Boston. And it hurts me to even bring this up because, you know, I love the church. It's been such a big part of my life. Mm-hmm. And you know, now to feel that so many people were hurt, and that hurt was being covered up. And so it hurts me to even, you know, say that.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk about a couple of issues you raised there. Certainly since the sex abuse scandals, there's been more talk about power sharing and democratic decision-making, more power to the laity. Richard McBreen, let's start with you. Tell us briefly where we stand with that now. I mean, are we going to see more democratization among the Catholic Church, at least in America?
Well, okay, my general answer is yes. I think the, you know, every bad event has some good aspects to it, I think the sexual abuse scandal, which has been so wounding to the church and continues to be a source of great pain to the Catholic Church, nonetheless has re-energized at least some parts of the laity. I'm a little bit biased on this point because an alumnus of the University of Notre Dame, Dr. James Muller, is involved here. But he, you know, his response to the sexual abuse crisis, and he's in Boston, was to do something constructive. And so he founded a lay group called Voice of the Faithful. Mm-hmm. And their motto is keep the faith, change the church. And their threefold agenda is to reach out to victims and survivors of sexual abuse, to support priests of integrity, and to work for structural change in the church and to offer their own services to help the church in its internal governance. So there are some positive things going on. Voice of the Faithful just happens to be one instance of that. Whether and when that will lead to more of a democratization, the way in which the church operates, laity much more involved in the life of the church, it would actually be not a new thing, by the way, and I'll end here, that if, for example, the church in America or the church universally adopted a system whereby the laity and clergy and religious had a meaningful role in selecting their bishops and selecting their pastors as well, that would be a return to a practice that was enforced through much of the first millennium. So in some cases, reform means retrieving a good aspect of our tradition, which was lost, and in other cases, it means adapting and developing new forms of church life.
Mm-hmm. Let's just take a quick break. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And helping us with this discussion are Richard McBreen, a professor of theology at the University of Notre Dame, and Peter Steinfels, a columnist and author of the book A People Adrift, The Crisis of the Roman Catholic Church in America. Peter Steinfels, you were going to comment.
Well, I think Richard McBreen spoke very well to the issue of democratization, but Greg, in fact, raised a very important point for the future of the church, and that is the question of generational change. I'm not quite sure where Greg fits into the generations, but it is my conviction from studying what data we have that there is a significant difference between the generations who were formed in a kind of highly defined, often ethnically based Catholic subculture that existed before the Second Vatican Council. Many of those people with that formation nonetheless welcome the changes of the council. On the other hand, there are generations now that have been formed, come to adulthood in some of the most exciting, but rapidly changing and in some ways unstable years of Catholicism after the council. And many of them strongly identify themselves as Catholics, but readily acknowledge that they're not entirely sure from their formation or upbringing what being a Catholic means. And I think that this is a real challenge to the church in terms of young adult Catholics and their general sense of being Catholic, but by and large their increasing disaffiliation from actual regular worship or parish life. So I wouldn't want that aspect of generational change to go by the board. It's terribly important.
Let me ask you this. Protestant denominations, I think, tend to have more lay involvement. Is that a model for the Catholic Church, or does the church's hierarchy get in the way of that kind of lay involvement that you see in Protestantism?
You're asking me?
Either one of you.
Yeah. Well, you know, I don't pretend to be an expert on the Protestant or Episcopal churches of America. You know, I must admit, however, I observe with a certain measure of envy the way in which the Episcopal Church in the USA goes about selecting its bishops, you know, with the lower house, so to speak, House of Deputies, with including lay people and the so-called lower clergy, and then, of course, the House of the Bishops. And it's a, you know, there's at least a process. Now, someone can immediately say, aha, but the Diocese of New Hampshire just elected Gene Robinson, who's a practicing homosexual and with partner and all that, and you see what happens. But, you know, you can take exceptions, and I'm not making taking a position on that. I'm just using that as an example. There are always exceptions, but at least in the churches where there is effective lay and lower clergy involvement in important decisions, as for example in selecting your pastoral leaders, you know, if the leader doesn't turn out to be very good, you know, at least you can look at yourself and say, well, we picked them or picked her. Whereas in the Catholic Church, the frustration comes, I think, for a lot of people, is that when they have a bishop that they're not terribly happy with for whatever reason, or a pope, and I'm not talking about this pope necessarily, the frustration is rooted in the fact that they had absolutely nothing to say about their appointment, and they feel that the man has been imposed upon them. And again, I want to emphasize this: to do otherwise is not to create a new tradition in the Catholic Church. That's the way it was through most of the history of the Church. Mm-hmm. And even one of the popes said that whoever is elected or selected to serve over all must be selected by all.
Richard McBride, stay with us. Peter Steinfels, we want to thank you for being with us. Peter Steinfels is the author of A People Adrift, The Crisis of the Roman Catholic Church. We're talking about American Catholicism today. When we come back from the break, we'll speak with a religious historian about the positive and negative consequences of Vatican II, plus why Catholic monasticism has such an enduring appeal. I'm John Idsty. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm John Idsty in Washington. Today, we're discussing the American Catholic Church on the eve of the 25th anniversary of Pope John Paul II. We'd like to hear from you. Should there be a change, or should the status quo remain in the American Catholic Church and the church hierarchy as it moves into the future? Call us at 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. When Vatican II went into effect in the mid-60s, it changed a great many things about the way American Catholics could worship. Joining me now to talk about some of those changes is Robert Lewis Wilkin. He's a professor of history of Christianity at the University of Virginia and the author of The Spirit of the Early Christian Thought, The Spirit of Early Christian Thought, Seeking the Face of God. He joins us here in Studio 3A. Thanks for coming in today.
Thank you very much. Pleasure to be here.
What were some of the changes brought on by Vatican II that are widely seen as positive reforms?
Well, you mentioned in the area of worship, I think probably the thing that most people would mention first is that for centuries the Latin Church, that is the Roman Catholic Church of the West, had worshipped in Latin, and with Vatican II, the vernacular, that is the native language of whatever country, became the primary language of worship. Another major difference was that shortly after Vatican II, for centuries the altar had been up against the east wall of the church, and the altar was moved out which is really the traditional way in which a Christian altar had been placed in churches. But a more significant change, perhaps, was that up to the time of Vatican II, the priest faced in the same direction as the congregation.
Mm-hmm. People, with his back to the congregation.
Well, that's a somewhat biased way of putting it. the point is that the congregation and the priests were all facing in the same direction, that is, offering their sacrifice mm-hmm. to God.
All in the same position, essentially.
Yes, exactly. Mm-hmm. Even though the altar was out from the wall historically.
Right.
Another very significant development that came after Vatican II was the development of the whole system for bringing people into the church, RCIA, the right for the Christian initiation of adults. And this is really a long period of instruction and then formation that begins in September, goes through Lent, and then winds mm-hmm. up at Easter, which is really an effort to try to restore the ancient way of bringing people into the church.
Mm-hmm. There were also some political changes, I suppose. You might say there was a comment and transformation of the relationship with the Jews coming up.
Yeah, I guess I would not really call them political so much as theological. One of the most important decrees of the council was called In Our Age, Nostra Aetate, which recognized the Jewish people in a way that had not been the case for centuries, namely to say that the promises of the election of the Jewish people were irrevocable, and that they remained the children of God, and that the church had a particular responsibility and relationship to them. It was quite unlike in relationship to any other of the religious traditions. And, of course, the church came out solidly for religious liberty and became a promoter of democracy. It's important to remember that for most of the church's history, it was monarchy. It was the king who was the head of the Christian people. So mm-hmm. those were all very, very positive changes.
Mm-hmm. Let's get our listeners involved. We want to hear from you. And so if you've got a question, please give us a call at, where's the number? I don't have the number here in front of me. 800-989-TALK, or send us an email at TOTN@NPR.org. But now let's go to Debbie in Broward County, Florida. Hello, Debbie. Hello,
Hi.
Debbie.
Can you hear me?
Yes, we can. You have a question or a comment?
Yeah, I have a comment. I was raised Catholic, and I'm in my early 50s, so I started pre-ecumenical council and have seen many of the changes. But there are a lot of things in the Catholic Church that still I have difficulty with, and I think our dogma that have dated back to medieval times.
Give us an example.
The schisms where the church separated, the Mary as having never sinned.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't understand how that could possibly be since Mary was human.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's only God who hasn't sinned. So difficulty with that. The infallibility of the Pope is another one. And I have to very strictly relate that to matters of church doctrine, because again, the Pope is a person.
Mm-hmm.
The worship of saints, where that a lot of teachings in the Catholic Church that are not strictly related to biblical teachings, such as let no man come unto the Father except through me, but yet in the Catholic Church we're encouraged to pray to saints for intercession and to Mary for intercession, worshiping of the statues remind me of idolatry, bingo games, and a lot of the fundraising. I think of, you know, Jesus threw the Pharisees out of the temple for doing that. And these are very widely practiced in Catholic churches in the United States. And
mm-hmm.
difficulty kind of rectifying that in my mind.
Let's ask Professor Wilkin to comment
I'll
on that.
Comments off the air.
Thank you very much for your question. What do you think of those issues, the things that seem archaic for many Catholics now, hard to believe? What would you say to a Catholic who's having trouble with those?
Well, I mean, that was a fairly long list, and each raise fairly serious theological questions. The infallibility of the Pope, I think it's important to remember that the Church was given a promise by Christ that the Spirit would be with the Church and guide it into all truth. And so when we speak about the infallibility of the Pope, we're speaking about the authority which has been given to the Church as Christ's own unique presence in the world, and that this authority is one that received a gift that it would teach the truth. And infallibility is a way of giving an institutional form or a structure to something which is at the very center of the Church's life, namely that it teaches the truth that it receives from Christ. The Marian question, I think what has happened since Vatican II is that Catholic theology has tried to explain more fully that the uniqueness of Mary, which is well documented within the New Testament, is the uniqueness which comes because of her relation to Christ, namely that it is Christ's sinlessness that becomes the basis for Mary's uniqueness and sinlessness.
We were talking a moment ago about the changes in Vatican II, and to your mind, there were some negative consequences from Vatican II as well, and not just the guitar mass, which so many people have learned to dislike.
Well, that I'd hardly agree with that. I think let's take the question of where the, if you said the priest with his back to the people or the priest facing the people, I think that the arguments that were made at that time were probably not as well founded as many claimed. And what has resulted is that by having the priest facing the people, the Eucharist, the Mass, has become much more of a kind of communal meal, a kind of imminent transaction among people, a very warm and friendly social act. Whereas historically, the Eucharist has been understood as a sacrifice offered to God. So I think that one of the consequences is that the transcendent element, the element of Christian worship that lifts one up to God, this has diminished. One can see that in the way in which prayers have been rewritten. And this isn't a matter of the use of English language. It's a language, actually the Latin prayers. I brought some along here, and you can see just how there's a certain sort of dumbing down. Can I give a few examples here? For example, here is a prayer. It says, "Lord, mercifully look upon our service. O Lord, we beseech you that what we offer may be a gift acceptable to you, and a support to our frailty." And the way it was then reformulated after Vatican II was, "Look mercifully upon our service, O Lord, that we may offer you a gift acceptable to you and an increase of our charity." So that the negative frailty was stricken out and charity. And so that means that the prayers tend to have a kind of a blandness to them.
You think Vatican II took some of the toughness out of
Catholicism? Well, it wasn't so much Vatican II. It was the liturgical scholars then who did the rewriting after Vatican II. Here's one that's even a little more dramatic. "O God, who unlocked for us the gate of eternity through your only Son, may we celebrate the solemnity of his resurrection through renewal of the Holy Spirit and rise from the death of the soul."
This is the original pre-Vatican II.
And then the version after Vatican II, "May, through the renewal of the Holy Spirit, may we rise to the light of life." So that it takes something out of the depth of the language, the religious language.
Let me just say that you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And with us is Robert Lewis Wilkin, a professor of history at the University of Virginia. Let's go back to the Eucharist, because on the one hand, you said that the meal, you feel the meal has become too communal. On the other hand, didn't Jesus at the Last Supper say, you know, "Do this as often as you eat and drink bread and wine to remember me"? So why shouldn't the Eucharist be that kind of communal meal?
It is that, of course, and it's always been that. But if it becomes purely a communal social transaction, then it loses its central significance, namely that it is a sacrifice offered to God, the sacrifice of Christ's death and resurrection. And perhaps it can be put this way. Many years ago, during maybe the 70s, Cardinal Avery Dulles, who wasn't a cardinal at the time, walked into church and he saw a banner, and it said, "God is other people." And he said he wanted to go up to the banner and he wanted to put an exclamation point and say, "God is other, exclamation point, people." Well, and I think that kind of catches the...
That's an interesting point, because we've recently... there's a bestseller book on the New York Times bestseller list now called Beyond Belief, the Gospel, the Secret Gospel of Thomas, one of these texts found in Egypt in 1945 that scholars have been working on, which actually makes precisely that point,
right?
But not a part of Catholic teaching now, and you'd say it shouldn't be.
No, I don't think it should be at all. I mean, obviously, there is a sense in which the community is the embodiment of Christ in this world. Yet, on the other hand, it's always turned to some deeper, higher, more transcendent reality.
We should say the Gospel of Thomas suggests that God is within everyone. And it was a gospel that didn't make it into the canon.
That's correct, yes.
Yeah. Let me ask you just a little bit about another issue that is, before the church now, and that is the celibacy of priests. And this has come up in the context of the sex abuse scandal. We know that it wasn't originally the case that priests had to be celibate. Now they do. Why the change, and what's your view? Should the Catholic Church decide to allow marriage by priests?
Well, it is true historically, and as Dick McBrien said earlier, the what's called Eastern Rite Catholics, that is people like the Greek Melkite Church, have ordained married clergy, as also do the Eastern churches. So it is not something that it's a discipline. It's a form of discipline. On the other hand, it's a discipline which has been characteristic of the Latin Church now for 1,000 years. And on balance, it has worked well. That is, the Church has done very well over the last 1,000 years with a celibate clergy. I guess you're kind of asking me to...
I think we need to wind it up here.
All right. I mean, I think the point being is that given the kind of cultural situation we're in now, it doesn't seem that this is the time to make such a radical change.
Thank you very much, Robert Lewis Wilkin, Professor of History of Christianity at the University of Virginia. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. I'm John Idstein.